All right, we can keep talking. We're going to keep talking. Thank you, Alex. We got Alex here helping out with the camera today. So,
and we're back with FDA Direct.
FDA Direct. And Bigfoot is still here. For those of you who might be concerned, Bigfoot is here. Good to see you. Thanks for your help setting up today. So we were just talking about this piece in the Journal of the American Medical Association that we have out titled Priorities for a New FDA.
I have it right here, hot off the press. Oh, congratulations, cool. You two.
Thanks. I was telling Sanjula, maybe we could chat a little bit about it today.
Let's do it. You know, you're a different FDA commissioner in some senses because you have a very aggressive agenda. You are firing on all cylinders in all fronts. You're not just popping into the office and then popping out to play golf, Marty. That's not how you're rolling.
Look, I think there's just a lot of great ideas that come from people at the FDA, and we've been going around asking scientists and reviewers and core staff, what big ideas do you think are important to consider that you've not really been able to do that we should consider? And so we've been getting great ideas. And we're doing the same with the industry, asking the sponsors, the developers and scientists who invent some of these drugs and products, what big ideas do you have for regulation? And we're learning a lot. So this is amazing right now. There's no shortage of giant ideas. So we've been doing this inventory for a while. We're going to keep going and keep listening. But there are some general parameters that I would say define our priorities at the new FDA.
And I would just add, I think one of the ways that you're soliciting these new ideas is by challenging everyone to challenge these longly held assumptions, right? And ask these tough questions, right? And so in this paper, you start off by saying, why does it take more than 10 years for a new drug to come to market, right? Which sounds like a simple question, but it's a really important one. And so what are you thinking about with some of these new ideas?
There is, by the way, a science to soliciting ideas. If you get people in a room with their bosses and you say, you know, how are things going? What ideas do you have? They're like, things are great. You know?
Yeah.
But if you get them alone and you give them anonymity and you keep it confidential with them and that you just let them open up, you start hearing amazing idea after idea after idea. And you think that makes so much sense. Now, some of those ideas are not good ideas, but when you hear them again and again from different people, you're really doing an inventory collection of ideas that is so much different from, say, a town hall or something where their boss is in the room. No, I'm not disparaging their bosses. We have great people here leading the FDA. But you get these great ideas from the front lines, from people on the ground doing this hard work of product review every day.
Well, you're having a dialogue, and a lot of people have told us that they haven't been asked these questions before. And so I think that's a lot of kudos to you for asking the questions. And so I think some of the ideas you have come up with are organized in some thematic areas. Maybe we can go through each of the themes.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, so this paper that we put out in JAMA, it's an amalgam of, I think, things that matter to you, priorities that matter to you, ideas you've heard from people out there, and we're trying to put them in some big buckets. And so maybe you want to run through the buckets?
Yeah, let's go through the buckets. So I think the first one is accelerating cures, right? That's a big one to unpack.
Yeah, look, this big assumption that we've had where it takes more than 10 years for drugs to come to market, we've got to challenge the processes that result in that long process. If you had the cure for breast cancer, do we really think it should take 10 years or even 6 years for that product to come to market? At the same time, if you lower the regulatory hurdle to have no barrier whatsoever, that is, you have no process, then you have snake oil out there and you have people who pay a lot of money for false hope and you do a lot of damage. And so
you've said many times that the FDA brand is, it means something. It means something in this country, it means something globally. And when we talk about accelerating products, we're not talking about watering down the brand. We're talking about speeding effective products to market. You know, we're not talking about lowering the standards for what it takes.
Cutting the unnecessary steps, the red tape, the steps that people are very clear, like people here are very clear, like we don't need to be doing this in this way. People on the outside saying we're submitting this stuff and nobody is using this information. It's unnecessary information. So we want to keep the integrity of the scientific process, but we want to see more cures and meaningful treatments for the American public. And the FDA, as you said, is an amazing brand, one of the best brands of any brand in the world. I mean, my grandfather overseas, he relied on that FDA brand as a clinician. And so he was a pharmacist, clinical pharmacist. So I think there's a lot we can do. And one of the cool parts of being in leadership at the FDA is you get to see things in the pipeline that are, they look amazing. I mean, we can't say they're amazing, but they sound promising. They have plausible mechanisms. They have incredible preclinical data. And so when you see something like that, especially coming right out of a clinical setting, you think, oh my gosh, like what can we do as you know, the human race to try to ensure this to be available and accessible in a way that we can safeguard public safety to keep to our charge to improve things as safe and effective.
Right. So something you both are talking about, right, is to accelerate cures, you have to maintain that rigor and that standard. And so maybe unpack a little bit some of the strategic principles you outlined of how do you reduce that time, right? You talk about things like animal testing and these process inefficiencies and these long applications, right? That those are all steps as part of this, right?
Yeah. So I mean, we talk about animal testing. We talk about perhaps a priority review system where we can shave even more time off the review, where the bulk of the review is looking at parts of the application that don't pertain to the pivotal trial results. So let's do that work while we're waiting for the pivotal trial to result so that we can pivot very quickly when the pivotal trial results.
And that's most of the application.
That's
most of the application is not the final readout on the clinical trial in the phase three portion.
I think one of the points that's made here is we write, to reinvigorate innovation, we must become a user-friendly FDA that partners with industry rather than takes a receive-only posture. You know, we're going to be a partner with industry. But we also write that at the same time, the FDA will guard against a cozy relationship that has characterized the agency in the past and led to allegations of industry capture. For this reason, we recently removed industry members from the advisory committees who were statutorily permitted. And in a recent VRBPAC meeting, which is the vaccine and related biological products meeting that I oversee, we actually did not grant Section 502 waivers, which is a certain type of potential conflict of interest for panelists. So we're taking conflict of interest seriously, but we are going to be receptive to the industry. We're going to try to do both these things.
And, you know, we hear a lot of great ideas, and a lot of these ideas that we're hearing make me think, can we create a pathway by which companies can submit the bulk of the application that includes a lot of the stuff minus the clinical trial endpoint readout? And so if we could get going on that CMC portion, now, right now there is something, I think it's called a rolling submission, where you can go in and start filling out parts of the final application before you submit the final application. But let's be honest, people have not been looking at it at the FDA, right?
So
they're busy, and so people have not been saying, oh, they pre-submitted parts of the CMC application. Let's go in and look at that ahead of the final submission. So it's not really doing much, right?
So you're basically suggesting a rolling review to pair with that rolling submission.
Or you sort of split the application into the CMC portion and the other portions that do not include the final clinical trial readout. And then, you know, another part of the application is the clinical trial readout.
So next item on the list, unleashing AI. So this is something that you're doing in-house. We have unleashed a pilot program for AI. But you're also talking about a few things that maybe people should know about, which is that right now we use a lot of animal testing. We write, quote, we have developed a roadmap to reduce animal testing using AI-based computational modeling to predict toxicity, leveraging chip technology. So we're not saying that, you know, we're 100% there yet, but we are aggressively moving in the direction where a lot of this toxicology stuff perhaps can be shifted to other platforms that are more efficient and also less wasteful of animals.
Yeah, so this is a big area of medicine right now in sort of the drug development space is, can you use computational modeling, organ on a chip technology where you've got the hepatocytes growing in a culture medium and you're actually testing the drug and looking at its impact on these liver cells and other organ system cultures. And organoid technology now. You can grow some organs in a laboratory. So when you put all that together, you actually have predictive information on, say, toxicity that is sometimes as good or better than animal studies, which are not very good. 90% of drugs that get through animal studies on toxicity end up not being found to be safe and
violent,
non-toxic, and effective in humans. Yeah. So it's not a very good predictive model.
You're really modernizing the various methods that we can leverage around here.
And if you can reduce animal testing, not only is it good for the, you know, Easter bunnies and all that, you know, the animals out there, there's a reduction in animal cruelty.
Yes.
But also you're reducing R&D costs, which could translate into lower drug prices, a big priority for this administration, and shortening the time, right? Because those animal studies take time.
Absolutely. So the next theme that you outline, I love this line, the FDA will restore focus on the F in FDA and providing healthier food for children.
So food is a huge priority here, healthy food for children. You saw our action on the 9 petroleum-based food dyes. You saw our roundtable on talc, which appears in food and candy that children consume. You saw some companies including, can I say Mars? I'm just going to say Mars. Mars announced they're taking titanium dioxide out of Skittles. Mm-hmm. Titanium dioxide is sort of used to coat things so that they can put that covering on top of it, be it a color coloring or artificial food dye. These are steps forward, and it is meeting consumer demand. The consumer is getting increasingly educated on these things. And of course, the big one is our dietary guidelines. So the secretary has asked us to work on the dietary guidelines. The old food pyramid is out. We are redoing all of that, and we're going to use the best available nutrition scientists and common sense. Because you can't just say grains on the food pyramid. You have to say what types of grains. You've got to talk about grains as super ultra-processed grains versus whole grains.
You talk about taking an inventory of substances that are banned in other countries but permitted in this country in our food supply, and also we're going to take a look critically at those products, those ingredients as well.
Yeah. I think we said in there something about the chronic disease epidemic rates are skyrocketing. This is not the fault of children, right? This is a byproduct of what they're consuming and their exposures.
Right. Okay, so then the next area you talk a lot about is harnessing big data, which I think really is the connective tissue with a lot of what you've already talked about.
Yeah, I mean, we live in an era where we have tons of data here, but there are huge, massive data sets, and a lot of people are interested in how you can leverage these things. And I think the 21st Century Cures Act actually gives us the statutory mandate to leverage real-world evidence and real-world data. And we're going to be thinking very critically about how to do that. Real-world data can inform our decision-making in a number of ways. We have already piloted things like target trial emulation, these sort of modern, sophisticated techniques to try to make sense of real-world data. But real-world data can be useful in our applications, and we're going to apply it, you know, as broadly as we can.
And I think it ties to a lot of your big focus on post-approval monitoring, right, as a way to also accelerate getting cures and meaningful treatments to market.
It's good for the FDA and the world to have eyes on a new drug or new device after it's approved. So we're not learning nearly 5 years later that Vioxx may have killed 38,000 Americans, or that OxyContin and the other opioids may have killed a million Americans, you know, 19, 20 years later. We should be having eyes on products as soon as they're approved. And if we can do that, it also gives us a little assurance as we review the applications, knowing we're not going to be just looking away once it's approved. And we haven't been able to do this in the past, right? This is not the fault of any prior commissioner for not implementing this. It's just now big data and cloud storage and the consolidation of big data has enabled good, rich electronic health record data, not just claims data, to be searchable. And so in the old days, when I say the old days, 5 years ago, when we were students or at any point in clinical medicine in my lifetime, if you wanted to run a good trial, you needed to run a randomized control trial. Where do you find the control group from? The reason we had to run randomized control trials is because the only way to get a good control was to randomize within your center or institution, or you parse together a couple institutions. When you have 100 million plus patients in an electronic health record, you can match people really well in amazing case control studies. You can match them by their A1C, their body mass index, their height, their kidney function, their hair color, whatever you want. And you can do incredible controls, and you can also do in silico controls.
In my group in CBER right now, you know, literally as we're talking, we're exploring a number of, and I can't say exactly what they are, but we're exploring a number of potential safety signals for vaccine products very aggressively using large real-world data. And this is something that you'll never see. I mean, we are big proponents of randomized studies, and everyone knows that for the COVID-19 vaccines that we've, in fact, tasked the manufacturers, and they have agreed to complete very important studies by the spring and summer of 2026. So we will start to get some readouts then. So we believe in them, and they do serve a valuable purpose. But you will never get a study to find a 1 in 200,000, 1 in 1 million rare adverse event. You're not going to get a randomized study capable of doing that, because the sample size calculation to prove it has a benefit is inherently smaller than the sample size calculation to find a 1 in a million safety signal. So how do you find that? So right now, on a number of potential and some maybe more plausible than other safety signals, we're running the exact type of analyses that Dr. McCarry is talking about, very well-matched, controlled analyses looking for these safety signals. When we find these safety signals, if and when we do, if they are sufficient to warrant regulatory action, it will be incredibly swift. And here's a shameless plug. Some people may know that last week in JAMA, there was a particular vaccine that we placed a pause on. It's a vaccine for chikungunya, a live attenuated vaccine that is being rolled out in the French island of La Réunion, where there is currently an outbreak. And we've detected a rather concerning safety signal that we are exploring. And in the meantime, we put a pause on it for a certain age group, 60 and up. And we wrote about that in JAMA last week. Now we're back again this week. So we're going to keep writing an article in JAMA every week now. So
that's great. You don't sleep very much. But, you know, speaking of safety signals, I think we've talked a little bit about this before, but in the spirit of the big data, we're also thinking about, or you're also thinking about, adverse event kind of reporting systems and reducing that clunkiness and kind of pairing some of that self-reported data with some of these other real-world data sources.
If we can get eyes in big data on FDA products, we can start by, say, going back over the last year, all FDA-approved products, including once we get a universal device identifier, more standardized in electronic health records, maybe even claims data. This is something we're talking to CMS about.
Yeah.
Then you can understand how they're working in the real world. You can develop synthetic controls. You can ask whether or not a drug we approve on surrogate endpoints also is associated with increased overall survival, whatever question you want to ask. And so that is powerful. But in monitoring safety signals, it is much better than these clunky adverse event self-reporting databases where people self-report. And you can make zero inferences. If we're being scientifically and methodologically honest, you can make zero scientific inferences about rates of adverse events with self-reported data.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the things that people don't appreciate. Although we have a number of safety systems in place, they suffer from two fundamental biases. One is that people see a side effect, an adverse event, and fail to report it. And then the other bias is that sometimes people report an adverse event, but it's actually not causally linked to the product. And so you get both types of errors.
And there's a third piece. You have people that want to report something, but then give up reporting because it's so difficult
to
report.
Now you're going to scoop us because we're running some analyses internally. Yes. But I've been meaning to ask you how that analysis
we're
is running.
We're working on it, yeah.
Yeah, you're working on it. But I think that you're absolutely right that, you know, reporting it shouldn't be. We all get surveys, and if the survey's got 17 pages on a survey, I ain't going to finish it, you know? Ask me one question, I'll give you one click, but I can't do 17 pages.
Click fatigue.
Click fatigue.
It's like alert fatigue. It's actually, doctors suffer from both.
Yeah.
Alert fatigue and click fatigue.
I mean, it wasn't that long ago, just last month, that I was in the EMR every single day, and I'll tell you, I was totally fatigued with that EMR.
Yeah. So it appears that most people who log on to our FDA adverse event reporting databases don't get through it and actually are able to report that adverse event. That's something that we're taking a closer look at.
Yeah, and we're going to write that up.
Absolutely.
So these adverse event reporting databases are not very good. I mean, they can give us a signal to look at with a more proper methodological study in big data, but we can make zero inferences about rates.
Yeah.
And so we need to do better. And also, why do we have so many separate adverse event reporting databases? Why do we have a separate one for devices, as we do for drugs, as we do for vaccines, as we do for other products? We can just have a question at the top. You know, what is this
which
adverse
product
event?
Which product
is this
pertain to?
Drug.
Right. Good. Well, so then the kind of final thematic area you've noted here is around financial toxicity, which I think was interesting to see because you say that although the FDA, per statutory law, will not consider price in the benefit risk calculations, the FDA will use its power to address costs in other ways. You want to elaborate on those other ways?
Well, we got to have lower drug prices in the United States, and we want to both encourage investment in new products, but at the same time, we don't want to be ripped off in the United States. So other countries have to pay their fair share. And so it's just like with anything else, be it NATO membership fees, we cannot be carrying water for the rest of the world when it comes to research and development. Now, research and development is roughly 15 to 20% of the spend, 15% of the revenue of many of the large pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
And just as a benchmark, their marketing and advertising budget is about 20 to 25% ballpark. I mean,
wow.
Something in that range. So that's a little, comparison. But we have got to have other countries pay their fair shares. It makes no sense whatsoever. The drug can cost over $1,000 in the United States and $100 in London or Germany or France. And this president does not like to watch Americans getting ripped off. And this has been one of the great American ripoffs. We need to come up with some sensible solution.
We can't consider price directly in our calculations, and we won't for novel products, but around generic drugs and the approval of generic drugs, around biosimilar drugs, and people say, what's a biosimilar? Biosimilar is a generic for a biologic product like a monoclonal antibody, or eventually there'll be a biosimilar gene therapy as time goes on into the future. We need to be very agile in facilitating these biosimilar approvals. We can't adhere to you need to do 7 randomized controlled trial non-inferiority studies in a different, all these different subgroups. I mean, I think we find already that a lot of those are not giving us new information, and they're kind of stifling biosimilar drug development. The more biosimilars you have on the product, I think there's elegant data that shows for each additional entrant on the market, roughly a 10% price reduction from brand price reduction. So it takes many entrants to really drop prices. And again, we're not doing that because of price. That's not our primary consideration, but it has that nice added benefit by being an aggressive FDA in that space.
Financial toxicity is a medical complication. And while we don't use price in the approval decision-making process, it's a real thing for many Americans. And the lack of affordability of some drugs is also an access problem in the United States. So there's a lot, it's a very complex topic. It involves PBMs. It involves the markups at the provider level, something that's not often discussed. And other countries sometimes are getting sweetheart deals negotiated, and we end up paying a lot more for some of these drugs.
So I learned a lot about this in The Price We Pay, your book, because you explored that years ago.
So there's something I've written a lot about. But so to be clear, the FDA does not set drug price policy. The FDA is not involved in drug price policy. But there are some things we can do. First of all, we can ask companies to have more affordable prices for Americans relative to the price of the same product in OECD countries, that is, other wealthy countries around the world. Second thing we can do is increase competition and bring more drugs to market.
Yeah.
And another thing is increasing generics and biosimilars, as you said. Biosimilars have a lengthy process for approval. That process is a pretty tried and true process because sometimes the manufacturing of a biosimilar is the drug, right? It has to have an impeccable manufacturing process. But at the same time, do we need a confirmatory trial for a biosimilar? We don't do that for generic drugs. We don't say, oh, you have a new generic drug. So let's see a clinical trial.
In some cases, multiple confirmatory studies for a biosimilar. But another thing I get asked often is, and this is kind of a wonky point, which is, does accelerated approval of one product in a space preclude subsequent accelerated approvals? And it is my personal view that it does not, that there can be other subsequent accelerated approvals. And it has two, I think, really relevant policy considerations. One, It gives us some safeguard in case there's supply constraint. If one manufacturer has a problem in the supply, there's another product out there for people to get that can be incredibly important. It provides a safeguard in case there's a safety concern. One product has a safety concern, there's a rival product, and it may have benefits in terms of negotiating price on the back end. So we are going to encourage that competition, and even in this subgroup of, you know, if an accelerated approval is granted, for a number of societal benefits, and also because that's, I think, our interpretation of the statute.
And I think just to connect the dots back to something you said earlier, Marty, right, another piece of how you're going to address the toxicity point is reducing the cost of the actual R&D part, right, with the animal testing and some of these
and
new
time
model
is money.
And time
is shave money. A year off and you shave off potentially billions of dollars in drug R&D expenditure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the value of a quicker decision, take, for example, some of these priority vouchers.
That's a better way to put it, yeah.
Right? So that if the standard time is 10 to 12 months, depending on some factors, then getting it down to 6 months with a voucher, priority voucher, which by statute they can be sold or transferable. So the value of that voucher sold on the open market tells us a little bit about the value of an earlier, and it's like 80 to 110 million, something like that.
You know,
in
like,
for a voucher.
Like a few years ago, there was that hospital that I think was going bankrupt, and they sold the residency. And then each residency position sold for not the salary that they pay a resident, but for like $170,000, like $150,000 per resident. But what it tells you is the real value of a resident for the hospital system, which is very valuable because residents, we know, work very hard and keep hospitals going. Similarly, the real value of a priority review voucher for the company is what another company would pay to get it.
And that's, if I get those numbers right, is that your understanding? They've been sold.
My understanding was even hundreds of millions of dollars that the priority review vouchers were sold. But it's been a while since I've last seen that price.
I think initially it was in the hundreds of millions.
And it came down.
But there have been, I think, over 50 of these vouchers issued over time. So as the market has more supply and demand, I think it's roughly $100 million. If not, there'll be 500 people that reach out to say we got
and then 17 attorneys.
Yeah.
Starting in 2 minutes.
Starting in 2 minutes.
Yeah. So I know we're hitting up against time, but there's one more point that I did want to flag. So although it's not a kind of bucket listed in the paper, you conclude by mentioning effectively that you plan to achieve these goals kind of all while rebuilding public trust. And I just want to call that out because I think you're already doing this. And I think that that is a big piece of what you're trying to bring, whether it's conversations like this and just being out, you know, with the industry, with staff here. But I think that's an important kind of priority that you do have.
Yeah. I'll add one thing on that. I think what we've done with the COVID-19 policy framework is exactly that. It's rebuilding public trust. We're coming in, I think, with a very nice solution. We talked about it so much on this podcast, I won't get into it again. But I think one of the other virtues is it's building public trust. I think these videos build public trust. I think our articles build public trust. And I think having those open town hall meetings that we are televising on, you know, YouTube and X build public trust. And what were we going to say?
Yeah, I think, you know, we'll put something out there. I mean, there's risk with it, right? You put something out there, you put an idea out there, and people say, that was a great idea, or that's a bad idea, and here's three reasons why. Good, that's what we want to hear, right? That's how actually you move. That's how we actually move the needle. And so if we just say, like, this is a system, this is the monograph recipe for infant formula, we came up with it in 1998, it's perfect, you know, we just added selenium once, but otherwise, this is how we do it. Nothing happens. You don't advance Western civilization that way, right? We're not moving the agency. We're not modernizing. So we want to put ideas out there, and we'll do it on camera.
And I think people don't recognize this, but in a big bureaucracy with lots of attorneys, and you come in and you want to do different things, there's always a bunch of people here who have had those ideas for years, but there's also some, you know, institutional pressure not to make those changes. And I think it does take leadership to say, despite these concerns to the contrary, we've got to make changes. We have to keep innovating. We can't just be the same stagnant FDA we've always been.
Yeah, you're encouraging discourse. So, you know, speaking of discourse, I have to say on a different topic, there was some commentary on both of your kind of fashion on these video discussions. So I have to check for the public here if you are wearing if you guys have exchanged socks or wearing the appropriate color socks.
So what, somebody didn't like the color of our socks?
Yeah, apparently you were wearing mismatched color socks on one of our recent discussions.
I wear black socks every day.
So you don't try to match
it. There's got to be one person implicated here.
Somebody didn't like, I think, the tailoring of my suit. I'll be perfectly clear. I'm not going to pass dye workwear standards. You know, this guy. I'm not going to pass this because I'm a professor and a government employee, okay? I'm not in the fashionable suit business. But having said that, you know, our focus is being professional, but I think getting the job done.
Yeah. Hair's looking good, man.
The hair I had to correct because this guy ripped on me the whole first video, that Einstein hair.
That wasn't a criticism, that was a compliment. Einstein was a genius.
Well, guess what? You know, I corrected my official portrait as well because it had that wild hair. But on Wikipedia, they refused to correct it and they put that wild hair out there.
Because they want to smear you on Wikipedia, of course.
The most imbalanced website I've ever seen.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad the socks check out. Thank you both for taking the time to write this out. I think it's a really important thing to commemorate, and looking forward to helping, you know, you achieve this agenda.
Thanks so much, Angela. Good talking to you guys. We said we'd do this in 5 minutes, and here we are probably 30 minutes into it,
but
it was fun. It's good discussion. Thanks so much. All right, folks, we'll do it again. See you later.